The Governor's Task Force on Teen Driving met on January 25, 2008. Please listen to the following task force meeting.
Good morning, everyone. It's my privilege to call to order this morning's meeting of the Governor's Task Force on Teen Driving. To again thank all the members of the Commission for their participation to date and say that I'm excited as we get to voting on the short-term recommendations, because I think we really will be giving to Governor Rell some important steps to take on the eve of the start of the Connecticut General Assembly, which puts us in a good position to really influence in favor of teen driving safety legislation that will come out this session. A couple of quick housekeeping things. Seated to my right is Dr. Norma Guile, who is the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Health, who will be sitting in this morning for Commissioner Galvin. And I'm particularly pleased to have that because Norma and I, Dr. Guile and I, worked together in the General Assembly starting back in 1985 as freshman legislators. So it's sort of fun for me to be, as two freshman people coming in, then to be sitting here chairing such an important group as this. So personally, it's exciting for me to have Dr. Guile with us this morning. On that note, I will say, I think in a couple of times folks have said to me, I can't make it to a particular meeting. Can I designate someone to sit in my place? I have no objection to that as a procedure. Certainly, commissioners frequently have deputy commissioners sit in our place on all official duties, but I would leave it open to the committee. If we will have a couple of votes being taken later today on recommendations we made throughout the committee work. The question is whether it's appropriate or not for a designee or a proxy, if you will, someone who attends the meeting in that place to cast that vote. If there's no objection from the committee, I would proceed in that way, but it is a committee decision, not my decision, so I'll simply open that for quick discussion of whether we should proceed with proxy votes or not. Is there anyone that wishes to discuss that? Is there any objection to allowing a proxy vote? Seeing none, when we get to voting parts of it, we will allow proxy. And that was not intended for just this meeting, but if there's a meeting that you can't attend, and so you want to designate someone to sit in your place, understand that if a vote comes up, they'll be voting for you in that place. And I think that works well for this commission. We want to move forward in a fair way, but we also want to be flexible, knowing that lots of the participants have a lot of activities that they're working on. If they miss a meeting, they don't want their voice not to be heard. With that, we'll proceed right on to the presentation. And again, I think the committee is very, very fortunate to have the work that was done on the survey concerning the public attitudes and parent attitudes on changes in laws with regard to teen driving. And Dr. James Hedlund will now lead us through the survey that this commission undertook. Thank you, Dr. Hedlund.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm here as a pinch hitter. This was work done by the Preusser Research Group, Trumbull, Connecticut. Dave Preusser has been before this committee before, I believe. Dave is unavailable to be here, and Neil Chaudhry, who designed and conducted the survey, is also on travel. So I'm pinch hitter number three. You should have copies of the handouts. There are more available if you need them. This was a survey whose objective is right there, to find the views of the parents and of other adults in Connecticut on the general initiatives being considered by this task force. The survey was designed and managed by Preusser Research, as I just said. The questions were developed in concert with Preusser, with the legislative subcommittee of this task force. The survey was conducted the first week of January by phone. These were random digit dial phone calls. Respondents were selected at random, about 400, both of parents and of other adults. Parents means parents of someone who is 15, 16, 17, who may be licensed or who may not. The sampling error in this is approximately 5% or less. That means if I report that something was agreed to or supported by 55%, then it could be between 50% and 60% if I ask the same question to every single parent in the whole state of Connecticut. So plus or minus 5%, some of them are smaller, none of them is larger. For the questions, here was a general strategy, where appropriate. Do you think this issue is a problem? Are you aware of the current restrictions and requirements on this issue? And do you support changing the requirements? Those are the three kinds of questions that were asked. There were a few other questions asked as well that I won't be talking about today, but are in the full survey, questions on driver education and some questions on the demographics, both of the people answering the survey and of the team, or the ones that are parents. The support, which is the issue I think that's most important to you, was recorded on a 5-point scale. Do you completely support this? Do you somewhat support it? You in the middle, neither support nor oppose, somewhat oppose, and completely oppose. And there were also responses were collected for I don't know or I refuse. There were very few don't knows or refuses on these initiative questions, and which says to me that the people of Connecticut, both parents and other adults, are very aware of these issues right now. It's very much in the news, and they've thought about them. So I think the answers that they give are quite accurate and quite appropriate. When I go on to talk about proportion support or proportion oppose, I will group the two together. So completely and somewhat counts as support. Completely and somewhat opposed counts as opposed. Here's an example of a typical set of three questions, and I pick nighttime. The are you aware of the problem is stated as such. How much do you agree with the statement that drivers under 18 are more likely to have an accident than older drivers? So that's an awareness question. Then there's are you aware of the current, do you think it's a problem? Then there's the current issue. Were you aware that these are the requirements for Connecticut? And then there's the initiative question, would you support an earlier time? So that's the general structure. For some of the areas, it's not appropriate to ask about current requirements because there are none and so forth. Here is the bottom line, one slide for you to remember that summarizes everything. Majority support both parents and others, other adults, for increased supervised driving hours, longer learner's permit period, longer passenger restriction period, and increased penalties for multiple moving violations. And I'll show you the specific numbers subsequently. About half support for earlier nighttime and increased learner's permit age above the current 16. And fewer than half support for stickers on cars to identify novice drivers. So that's the summary. Let's look at them one by one. Supervised driving. Current, parents are required to provide 20 hours before a road test. Support for increasing 3/4, both parents and other adults. And most of this, as with most of the others, support is complete support. In this case, 61% of the parents said, I completely support this. So it's very strong support from both parents and from other adults. Learner's permit, they're the current requirements. 6 months, both in general, reduced to 4 months with driver education. Support for increasing, about 2/3, again, both parents and others. Passenger restriction. The current requirements is first 3 months, only the supervising driver and or a parent. The next 3 months, family members only. You've seen this as an issue in the Wallingford crash just a couple of days ago. Support for increasing, again, 2/3, both parents and others. 2/3 support in polling or in politics is landslide. So landslides so far. Repeat violation penalty, they didn't ask about current because the requirements are somewhat confusing, but support for increasing, again, almost 2/3, both parents and other adults. Now we're into the about half category. The first four were strong support. Here's the all about half. Earlier start to nighttime restriction, just over half for parents and almost 60% for other adults. And this question was asked, do you support increasing, starting the nighttime restriction earlier than midnight? That was the answer there. There was a follow-up question which said how early, and I won't go into details on that, but the information is available in the full survey. Learner's permit age, there's the current requirement. again, about half, a little under half for parents, a little over half for other adults. I was surprised with this, that parents in general are about half and half on should I increase that beginning age above 16. So this is a sort of a right in the middle one. Then the one that clearly did not get support was the stickers to identify a car driven by a novice driver, in other words, one under 18. 38% support for parents and 43% for other adults. So in a nutshell, that's what the survey said. Here are a couple of other observations about the survey. There were very few don't know or refusals on any of the questions. Typically, it was about 2%. As I said before, people are very aware of these issues. And there were also very few neither support nor oppose, people in the middle, typically about 4 or 5%. So most people not only knew the issues but had positions on the issues. So support means they really do support. And again, most support is complete support. It varies by specific issue, but typically the complete support is 2.5, 3, 4 times as much as the somewhat support. So the numbers previously that you saw, when it said support, that meant strong support, is how I would interpret it. The parents are very aware of the current requirements. Just as an example, nighttime learner's permit age, nighttime, well over 90%. Parents know what the rules are. General public is somewhat less aware of the rules, but still fairly much. General public knows the learner's permit age, 84%. General public isn't as aware of the nighttime restrictions. That's the summary. Again, the survey was done by Pricer Research, and I'm the pinch hitter, and I will be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there questions? Tim.
Tim, was there a seatbelt question?
There was not.
Did anything surprise you, Jim, about these results?
It surprised me from experience elsewhere that there was so strong support by both parents and general public for those first four initiatives. I thought that was very positive for the work that this task force is doing.
From the survey, I saw the one thing where there was not support was the identifying by a placard or sticker of some sort the vehicle is being driven by a young driver. Did some people give reasons for that, or is there an explanation for that? Could you expand upon that a little bit, or not?
I don't know more than the numbers that you have here. This was a survey done by a firm that does telephone surveys. Okay. Electronically, you get the response, you plug it in. There may be specific comments, there may not. I can tell you on that one, that the opposition was fairly strong. Parents completely opposed 45% of the time that sticker requirement. General public completely opposed 37% of the time. So it was fairly strong opposition, but I do not know reasons.
And from those numbers, if I understood them correctly, and parents even more strongly.
Parents even more strongly opposed than general public. That's an observation throughout. General public is slightly more supportive of all of these requirements than parents are. In some cases, it's very close. In this one, it's a little greater.
Commissioner, just to give you a little bit of anecdotal insight into that, one of the emails that Bill Seymour forwarded along to us was a mother who was the parent of two teenage drivers who very strongly supported the vast majority of what we were doing, but her opposition to the sticker was that it would identify young drivers for potential predators, and the example she cited was the rental car issue in South Florida that happened a few years back, where that was used by criminals to identify people who had rented cars and might be more susceptible to being robbed.
I appreciate that, Dr. Kennedy. I just didn't know I didn't think in the survey we took any verbatims from people, and I was just trying to see if we did have those, if that backed that up or not. But
I'm sorry, I do not know.
That's fine. And also to confirm, it seemed like, but understood you correctly, there was majority support amongst parents for increasing the age for initial issuance of the learner's permit, or close to majority support.
There it is.
I'm sorry, 46%.
46%.
Okay.
So about half.
So within the margin of error, it's kind of 50-50.
Within the margin of error, it's close to 50-50. And again, this is what I was saying. Other adults typically support these things a little bit more than the parents do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, Bob.
You mentioned some numbers that are in like the 90% range for the awareness of current requirements. Do you have any reason to interpret that other than 90% of the people are aware of that? I mean, would there be any tendency for somebody to answer in the positive, even though they maybe weren't real familiar with it? It seems inconsistent with some of the things we hear.
I doubt it. These are parents either who have teens who are already in the system or who very shortly will be in the system. And I bet every teenager in the state of Connecticut knows the minimum age is 16. And I bet virtually every parent knows the same thing. So I think those numbers are quite accurate. This is personal opinion now.
Thank you. Any other questions from members of the commission?
If not, again, I would like to thank Dave Presser and his group and Dr. Edlin for the presentation. And I would simply comment that as we get to that part of the meeting, a lot of the things that we have here that are recommended by the subcommittee have very strong public support, which I think puts us in good stead as we advance it to the governor and then things move from the governor to the legislature. It is always useful to be able to say not only do we think they're good ideas and that they'll work, but to know that they have a broad base of support throughout the public in Connecticut. And I think the survey certainly backs that up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will be glad to answer any other questions afterwards.
Thank you. With that, at the last meeting, we indicated an issue that had arisen is, what does the Department of Motor Vehicles do with records? Do we receive records from the Judicial Department? How is that handled? And what I indicated is we'd provide a presentation to you regarding the record keeping on driver records and driver history and coordination of those records. And with that, we proceed to a presentation from the Department of Motor Vehicles. And just look, and it's... Sue Archambault and Kathy Flanagan Beale from the Department of Motor Vehicles that do have a presentation for us. Kathy and Sue.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Kathy Flanagan Beale, and this is Susan Archambault. We're from the Driver Services Division of the Department of Motor Vehicles, and our charge in the Department of Motor Vehicles is to maintain the integrity and ensure the integrity of the driving history for all operators in the state of Connecticut. Our focus today is really about teenage drivers, but the process that we're going to describe to you really affects all drivers in the state of Connecticut. It's not limited to teenage driving necessarily. I do not have copies of the slides for each one of you, but it will be posted to the website, your website, at the conclusion of this presentation. Bill Seymour has it to post to the website. So, with that, we can start. This is about teenage drivers. And we can tell you that, I'm not going to repeat the numbers to you, but we can tell you that this is the number of drivers, licensed drivers, at the end of 2007 in Connecticut. So we can assume that those 37,000 operators that have learner's permits will go into that 16 to 17-year-old licensed drivers by next year. The next slide is a little more complicated, and this is what really happens when a person receives a conviction in the state of Connecticut. The person receives a conviction from a police officer, and the Department of Motor Vehicles Driver Services Division, receive that information from judicial, from DMV, or from an out-of-state jurisdiction regarding a conviction. That information, for the most part, is transmitted electronically and posted to our operator control system, which is the next block here. After that, when it comes through the system, it gets posted to a driving history here, and the system, a lot of this stuff is electronic, and the system reviews this driving history to make sure that sanctions are properly imposed if they're supposed to be. And if the sanction should occur based on what's on the driving history, then the system then generates the letter. So if it's no, the conviction is merely posted to the driving history and stays there for whatever the appropriate retention period might be. If it's yes, then a sanction is taken, an action is taken. It may not be a suspension. It could be a suspension, but it may also be a requirement in lieu of a suspension. If an operator has too many moving violations in the operator under the operator training program, which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, you send them a letter. We'll send them a letter that says you have 60 days to complete the operator retraining class, and if you do, you won't be suspended. If you don't, then we will suspend you until you actually complete the class. And then, so we generate that letter, and the operator, in the letter that the operator gets, they're advised of what they need to do to be restored or otherwise comply with whatever requirements. I can tell you that we get about 10,000 to 15,000 convictions each week reported through just through judicial. That's not including the internal request or the outside of Connecticut jurisdictions that report violations. So there's a lot of, and that's not limited to teenage drivers, that's everybody. I'll also tell you, just back to that for 1 second, that we have had quarterly meetings with CIB and judicial for approximately 10 years. And that's been to resolve any outstanding issues, because obviously judicial is our primary customer. And it's been quite helpful in resolving issues, transmission, understanding, compliance. It's resolved a number of issues between the agencies and resolved problems relative to posting of driving histories. So, then we're going to talk about how long things stay on the driving history. Moving violations stay on about 3 years from the conviction date. And the moving violation is really what I characterize as the run-of-the-mill speeding violation. I don't mean it's run-of-the-mill, but the less serious violations that occur. Stop sign. The less serious violations. Those stay on for 3 years. And if there are points on the system, then if there are points relative to the violation, they're posted to the driving history if a person appears in court. If they mail in the fine to the Centralized Infractions Bureau, there are no points on the driving history. And that's in accordance with some legislative action that occurred several years ago that eliminated the points just based on the violation. You need to go to court to get some points. These violations, which are characterized as serious violations, stay on a person's driving history for 10 years. And for violations that like these, for example, the DUI, the 14227A, that counts for other issues relative to suspension. So in the operator retraining program, the 14227A counts as one of the moving violations that sent you to the operator retraining program, and that stays on your driving history for 10 years. So for a person under the age of 24, a 227A and a stop sign violation will get you to the retraining class. If that person has no other violations till they're 26 and they got the stop sign violation when they were 24, another speeding violation will send them to the class again, because the 227A is on there for 10 years. And the first speeding is on for 3. So when they have 3 violations, they're going to go to the class again. So that the 10 year, we sanction according to what's on the driving history is really what it comes down to. Any other violations, the other suspensions and actions purge after 3 years, provided the license or privilege is restored. The next slide will tell you that if you don't get restored, and we have people that don't get restored, Those suspensions stay on the driving history indefinitely. They do not purge. People think that if I just ignore my unpaid ticket for 10 years, then pretty soon I'll be able to get my driver's license back or my privilege to operate. And the answer is no. We have no sense of humor. We keep you suspended. The operator training program is the program that under Connecticut General Statute 14111G. And that is for operators who are convicted of moving violations and are required to attend a 4-hour class provided by vendors that the department contracts with. And those classes are held in a variety of locations by four different vendors. People are expected to attend and successfully complete that requirement in order to get their driver's license restored or not suspended. If they complete it in the 60-day window, there's no license suspension, and there's no record of that on their driving history at all. It appears on their driving history if you don't do it within that 60-day window. Here's the number of operator retraining class requirements that appear on our driving history currently at the, through the end of 2007. There's 14,000 kids between 16 and 19 who have had requirements to attend a class. I don't need to read you all the numbers, but the numbers increase. And the 16 to 24 group needs two violations to attend a class. If you're 25 and over, you get the opportunity to have three violations. But as I said before, you could be in that 25 or over group and have violations that occurred before you were 25 that still impact your requirement to attend the class because you got a violation when you were 26. Not all of those people have attended. That's a three-year look back because that's, for the most part, how long most things stay on the violations. This is another sanction that's imposed on underage drivers, and this is the 3088A is a taking your driver's license into a taking somebody else's driver's license in or modifying your driver's license into a liquor store, package store, and purchasing alcohol, or any place for that matter, and purchasing alcohol. That requires a court appearance, and a conviction of that generates a 150-day license suspension. The possession of alcohol by a minor in any public or private location in accordance with 3088-89B1 or 2 generate different suspensions. Previously, the license that was up until this past year, probably just about a year ago, last July, June or July, the change from a mandatory court appearance to a mail-in infraction. So one of our next slides is going to show you a huge jump in the numbers of them. But it used to be also a 150-day suspension. It's been reduced to a 60 and 30-day. The 60-day suspension is if you're on a public street or highway, and the 30-day suspension is if you are in an other than public street and or a private location. Those are automatic suspensions, and those are mail-in fines. The 3088 requires a court appearance. So you can see over in 2007, the 3088Bs that went from 150-day suspension and a court appearance to a 30- or 60-day suspension and a mail-in infraction really jumped in 2007. We don't know if it's increased enforcement. We really can't identify the cause of that jump except to say that it became a mail-in infraction and perhaps police officers were more free about issuing those tickets. We don't know that. And maybe kids mailed in the fine without telling their parents. We don't know that part. We just get the convictions.
Let me interrupt you there 1 second, because I think it could be a little confusing. Where that jumped a lot was where the law changed. It used to be it was an arrest, a summons, and a court appearance. In 05 and 06, the law then changed. So that offense of possession of alcohol by a minor, which is not connected to a motor vehicle or doesn't need to be connected, it's unrelated to a motor vehicle. The number of offenses went up substantially. And until July of last year, it carried a 150-day license suspension.
That's correct.
And that was changed by the legislature to either 30 or 60 days. An issue had arisen when it switched to infractions. People were mailing them in. Our department got lots of phone calls saying, what do you mean there's a 150-day suspension? Because there was a lot of people didn't realize when they mailed in the infraction that there was a license suspension coming with it. And they started to move to go to court to reopen cases and the like. The legislature in part reacted to that by saying, we'll leave a suspension in place. And again, this was possession of alcohol. It could have been in a dormitory room, for example. And then you had the 150-day license loss, which ironically was longer than if you were arrested for a per se violation of operating under the influence. So you see a big jump there that there was a change in the law. It remains, we'll see next year, it remains an infraction with a license suspension, but a shorter one than prior. So I apologize for the interruption, but I just wanted to make sure people we got a second explanation of that, because it was a, we noticed within Kathy and Sue's division of driver services, the number of phone calls that came in were quite substantial when people were receiving notices of 150-day suspensions and they hadn't been in a motor vehicle. And they would appear the public at that time was unaware. Many of the public were unaware that that was the penalty, which, again, I think shows how important some of our awareness programs will be in the future. As we make changes, we make, it's only effective if people know that's the potential penalty.
And that penalty has been in place since 1994. It's not a, it was not a new penalty, the 150-day suspension. It's been a lot, around for some time.
But if you notice, in, if you look at that in 2002 and the like, there were maybe 200 of those arrests.
Right.
It jumped to 1,700, and that changed who was contacting the Department of Motor Vehicles and who was hiring a lawyer and who was filing motions with the court and all of those sorts of things. Thank you, Kathy.
This is a driving history of a real teenager. We didn't do anything, we didn't have to create this, and I will tell you the sad comment to this is that when I said to the staff in driver services, I need a lousy driving history of a kid, in no time at all, I had a half a dozen driving histories of under 21 drivers. This was the best example because this person has been busy and done a lot of things. And I know it looks confusing, but I think there are some things that are really important that you understand about what's occurred in the past. We know, because of this NDR inquiry, which is a National Driver Inquiry, that this person got their driver's license in August of 2005. In November of 2005, November 14th, this operator received an unreasonable speed ticket, 14218A. Paid that fine and was posted to his driving history. And also on that same day, that same operator, same incident, because it's the same docket number, which doesn't, you know, care about, got a violation of 1436G. So that person had passengers in their car that they should not have had. That didn't generate any license suspension, but undeterred, this operator went on. And got another violation, a stop sign violation, in July of 06 in Farmington. And you see here the point, you can't read it very well, but this column here is the points column. And this person mailed that fine in and got no points. That B tells us that he mailed the fine in to Centralized Infractions Bureau, did not appear in court, so therefore no points were assigned to his driving history. It's important to know also about points. The point system is when it was modified to change it so that a mail-in fine didn't generate a license suspension, a points assessment. If you get a suspension for points on your driver's license, you usually have some other suspension going on. It's hard to get 10 points, which is what generates a suspension. It's hard to do that. You've done a lot of other things before you get to the 10 points. Then in July 15th of 06, this operator got a ticket in Clinton. And it's an unpaid ticket, 14140. We happen to know, because the person paid it down here, someplace. Oh, right here. It was a registration of 1413. We happen to know that that's what the underlying charge was, because they subsequently paid it. But in July 15th, they got a ticket in Clinton and chose not to pay it. So in November, the court's asked to suspend the operator, which you'll see here. The person was suspended until they comply with the ticket. And January 27th, they indicated, they provided us information that they had paid the ticket, or resolved the ticket in the court, and paid us a restoration fee. In November of 06, this operator got another unreasonable speed ticket in Simsbury. Same thing, mailed the fine in. No consequences at this time. And also at the same time, same as in Windsor, got the unreasonable speed and a violation of the passengers in his or her vehicle. Now, in this case, because it was a second conviction, a suspension was generated. The ironic part about that is that the suspension was imposed on January 10th, 2007, and because the law currently says that the suspension is until you're 18, this person was only suspended for 2 days. Because that person turned 18 on January 12th. they didn't get restored until January 27th, but their suspension in that particular situation was just for 2 days. And they moved on. All of these prior violations generated the requirement for this operator to retrain the operator retraining program, the 14111G, that he had to take the class. Well, this operator was notified on or about the 2nd of February that he or she had 60 days to take the class before they were suspended. Well, they didn't take the class until after April 2nd, and were subsequently restored when they took the class April 9th of 2007. So that's the only reason that suspension actually shows on the driving history. If they had taken it prior to the 60-day period, there would be no record of that 111G on their driving history. But it took the class sometime prior to April 9th. But in September 27th, got another unreasonable speed, 218A violation in Simsbury, a speeding ticket in Simsbury, a equipment violation in Simsbury. This person shouldn't stay in Simsbury, I guess. And then again in October of 2007, got another unreasonable speed violation in Simsbury. They are currently suspended here under 14111, the power of the commissioner, too many moving violations. And they're suspended for 30 days, effective January 9th, and they'll be eligible for restoration on February 8th of 2008 with payment of the restoration fee. Now, if this person continues to get violations, we're going to review, the system will automatically go back and review the driving history again and sanction the person accordingly. If they get more moving violations, they'll be suspended again. And based on this relatively short history, I bet we're going to see this person again. Do you have questions about that? I mean, it's a complicated kind of driving history, but...
Kathy, trying to understand, what was the time frame from the violation or the arrest that led to the suspension? Am I looking at that? It's 11/04/06, and the suspension took effect on January 11th, so it was a little more than 60 days. Am I reading that right? Right in the middle.
11. What?
Right. That's the arrest, and then the suspension was January 10th of 07, so it was about 60 days.
Right. Because when they get the notice, we get the report of the conviction. So you're talking about this. Right here.
Right.
So we were notified he was convicted on January 10th. He was convicted on January 1st. I mean, December 1st. See, the December 106? And then we sent out a notice that gives him about 30 days for the suspension to be imposed. And we do that because we also provide them their opportunity for a hearing if they claim they're not the person who was involved or did not receive that violation.
Okay, but that's with a mail-in.
So he mailed in the ticket the court reported a conviction on 12-1 and notified us that he had mailed in the ticket for this violation. We got it, posted it to our system, and generated a suspension on January 10th. December.
Okay,
10th.
So that's what I'm getting at. Where we had an arrest in early November and a mail-in ticket,
yes.
It was about 60 days before the license was suspended.
That's correct.
Okay, so my next question is, what happens if somebody contests the violation? How long can it be? And you know, the issue here is we're dealing with, if we're talking about 16 people licensed at 16 years, 6 months to 18, it's only 18 months. And, you know, if the violation takes 60, 90, 120 days to resolve, we have huge chunks in that critical window of inexperienced drivers.
That's correct. You are correct.
Right.
And the answer is that we don't get anything until the matter has been resolved through the judicial process. So if the person challenges it and gets 10 continuances, we're at the end of the line. We don't get it until it's all done, all resolved. So, yes, your conclusion is correct.
The only exception to that, which we haven't gotten to in this case, didn't involve, is the DUI cases. On the per se suspensions for drunk driving, we get the arrest report. We don't wait for convictions. We have a whole separate program based just on arrests and an administrative process. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But for all other types of motor vehicle offenses, as Kathy so correctly said, motor vehicle department and its sanctioning is at the end of the line. They first have their day in court, whether that's a mail-in system or physical appearance. So we're dealing with convictions, and by the definition of dealing with a conviction, we don't see it until the court process is over. There is an exception for that in the drunk driving, and that's why there's two things in drunk driving: court, judicial, and administrative per se. And we'll get to that a little later. And what Kathy said is absolutely correct, though, in terms of when we sanction. And Tim, you're correct in terms of then there's a period of time that is normal in these. We move with them pretty promptly when we get them, but between arrest and conviction, there's always a gap.
Well, yeah, this is the one that's personal with me, because my son got his second violation on October 5th, and he got the letter for 60 days of driver retraining, and he died 10 hours before he was supposed to get retrained.
Kathy, I have a question. For the provisional license, these 16 and 17-year-olds, do the parents get a copy of that letter? They do not. Is that by...
It goes to the licensed operator. We don't have any in our system currently. We do not have any connection to parents on our driving histories. There's no connection to anyone. It's the operator. The operator's advised of the notice of the action.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm speaking now as a parent and not as a Big A instructor. When my son was 16, several months after he started driving, I suspected that he had gotten maybe a couple of tickets and he was keeping them from me or keeping the information from me. And I went over to Weathersfield, second floor, tried to get his driving history, and I was told I had no right to see his driving history. This is a problem. If we want parents to be connected, to be involved, to be aware of what their kids are doing and put the clamps on their teenagers, they need to be able to see their children's driving histories. We get sued if our kid crashes into somebody and kills them. We're the ones who are going to be sued in civil court. Why shouldn't we know what they're doing? Why is it being kept secret from parents?
I guess I'd just quickly respond that the law would need to be changed. There is a statute that makes the driving record confidential, generally speaking, and there are exceptions to it. I do not believe there's an exception to it that gives a parent a direct access to the child's driving record. And then again, the second thing is pointed out is, because I know there's going to be some talk about automatically notifying the parent, we will need to build into the system to do that some linkage, because there isn't now, and obviously you can't match last names. That doesn't work. We'll need to collect data in some manner that says... So there's an electronic linkage to who would get notified if there was a ticket. I'm sure we could eventually do that, and I don't mean to make it takes forever. We would need to build into the system the ability to do that. It just isn't it's not an automatic thing. We don't have a secret button we can push that will tell us that my kids' names and where a notice should get sent if they were still under 18 or whatever the reporting age would be. It's something we can certainly look at. We have not begun to look at yet. But your other question was that there's a federal and a state Driver Privacy Protection Act that limits who has the right to personal information. So the general policy is you can't just go in and ask for somebody's driving history. I'm sure that could be addressed in legislation to give an adult parent who signed for somebody the right to get those records. Then we just have to figure out how to deliver that information.
Oops.
Sorry, Sherry.
Kathy, can you expound on the communication systems between judicial and the Department of Motor Vehicles? And is there any delay between the conviction date and the date that DMV is alerted to the conviction?
Well, there's delay. Our system currently does what we call a weekly update. So we get the information and it's posted to the driving histories on each weekend currently. We're in the process of re-engineering our entire system, which will make all that daily. But currently it happens on a weekly basis. We post the convictions to the driving history and sanction or review the driving history for appropriate action. The only delay in that, it might be if we get incomplete or inaccurate information from judicial. When judicial enters the information, they take the information from the citation written by the police officer in the field. And they don't necessarily, there may be an error. They could have transposed a license number. They may have a name that's incorrect. They may have a date of birth that's incorrect. So that would go to what we call our error list, and we get about 3,000 of those every week. And that delays because it requires individual research for that particular record. So that would delay the posting of that violation to a driving history.
Absent those types of delays, are you saying that within a week after the conviction, DMV has the information?
Yes.
Thank you.
If everything's right, that's reasonable.
It's absolutely accurate. The one thing this doesn't talk about is every once in a while a judge in a criminal matter will add a penalty that affects a driver's license, not one that's called for in the statute as a condition of probation, for example. That isn't always communicated to the Department of Motor Vehicles. And so if a judge says it in an open courtroom, Kathy's unit doesn't post it to the driving history because we don't have some way of hearing what happens in individual courtrooms unless it's communicated to us. All of the things that we've described, the tens of thousands of cases that come in, those all get handled quite well and get into the history within that week lag time unless it's in an error case. But on the sort of unusual cases where there's this extra sanction that the court has the power to do, that has to get handled on an individual case-by-case basis. And there certainly have been occasions where somebody said, well, why wasn't that sanction issued? And it's because our department was unaware that a court order had issued. And that's an area that, again, with judicial, there's constant communication on the electronic transmissions, and that handles pretty well. The other is very rare, but it does occasionally happen. And, you know, we need copies of orders faxed over or something like that, because the truth of the matter is if we don't know what occurred in one of many courtrooms throughout the state, then our folks can't take action because they're simply unaware of it. But I think the courts are aware of that and try to address it and try to get us a notice. Those, again, are very rare cases. They're not the normal cases. Thank you.
Go ahead. You said 3,000, your error list is 3,000 per week. Is that new?
Average.
Yeah. Is that new errors or is that like a running list?
New.
New errors. And you, I think you said before you were processing like 10,000 to 15,000.
Well, the 10,000 to 15,000 that come every week, that 3,000 will be part of that.
But is that the right relationship, that that's potentially a third to... So, in practice, the delays could affect a significant number of
Absolutely.
What's happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. And actually, I know that one of the goals that we have, and I don't want to speak out of turn here, is the barcoding, doing the scanning of licenses, which will obviously help a police officer, because that's really where it starts, in the field. You're writing a ticket in the rain in the dark, you know. I understand the practical problem. But then you have another person. There's a lot of hands that touch it. So another person is entering it when they get it, and if they can't read it or don't understand it, that potentially creates an issue. So if we start with the police officer who issues the ticket initially and can scan the driver's license, which would automatically populate the ticket, obviously the information that we get is that much cleaner and processed that much more quickly.
Yep.
And then we have youthful offenders. In accordance with the statute, youthful offender information is confidential. And the court operations does not send information to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Now, for purposes of this presentation, we inquired to the judicial branch, and they advised us, they shared that there was 333 motor vehicle-related cases last year that were not forwarded to the Department of Motor Vehicles. So that means that 333 people took that youthful offender status and were not potentially sanctioned on their driver's license. Now, I will tell you that, and the commissioner alluded to that, I know that in one particular case, I had a call from a clerk in a court who said that the judge was going to grant youthful offender status to this operator. It was a DUI, and wanted the operator suspended for an additional period of time in addition to the per se sanction that we impose. So the clerk called and said, how do I get this person suspended at the end of their current suspension? I don't want them to run simultaneously. I want it to be consecutive suspensions. So we figured out how that could happen and how they had to communicate that, and that information was then posted to that operator's driving history and was added to the end. It won't start until the per se suspension ends. But that's unusual. That's very unusual. Mostly we don't know anything about youthful offenders at all. That happened to be someone, and I don't know the details of the case. I don't know anything about it. But that did happen. So sometimes it does happen, but it's really very, very infrequent. This is the Department of Motor Vehicles administrative per se actions. Now, this is the administrative license suspension by the authority of the commissioner following the failure or refusal of a blood alcohol test. I mean, a breath chemical alcohol test. Actually, for all of these, and I don't need to read them, you can see them, but the penalties are all doubled for those that are under 21 if they refuse to submit to a blood, breath, or urine test. Currently, there's the blood test. If you take a blood test, the suspension is only 90 days. There's a bill that I understand has passed the General Assembly and is expected to be signed, if it hasn't already been signed, that will make the penalties for blood results the same as the breath and the urine. So they'll all be consistent. These are test results if the alcohol level is higher. Maybe. Also, again, doubled. And then if they're really drunk, the penalties get that much higher. So in this case, you could have a person who is 20 years old and the test results are 0.16 or higher, and conceivably that person would be suspended under the per se statute until they're 25. It's also important to remember that these are completely separate, as the commissioner pointed out, to the judicial process. This is the administrative action by the Department of Motor Vehicles, completely unrelated to whatever happens in the court. They really don't ever connect. They're separate paths. A person could be suspended under the per se statute and not in accordance with the court. They could lose in the court and be suspended and win in the administrative per se. They don't connect. They're separate, they're parallel, and they are essentially unrelated, except for the impact on your driver's license. These are the penalties for if you are convicted in court. For under 21, the penalties are the same. You got one. Actually, the first suspension, the first conviction is often really second action, second DUI. In most cases, the first DUI conviction in court, the operator, based on their driving history and some conditions that the court establishes, would be offered the alcohol education program. And if they get the alcohol education program, there is no DUI conviction that's posted to their driving history. The alcohol education program, once they've completed it, stays on their driving history for 7 years, but not as a conviction. It's merely an information line that says alcohol education program. That's all. So the first conviction is kind of like their second, for lack of a better term. But no matter what age you are...
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay.
Susan Abe, who prosecutes some of those cases, wanted to add something there, Sylvia.
I think it's important that the task force be aware of issues with youthful offender status and with this pretrial diversionary program for DUI. The alcohol education program is designed for first-time offenders of the DUI statute, which enables them to go through a program without any consequence in terms of conviction on their record. What we are finding, and we would like very much to have changed, is that some judges are offering youthful offender status for the first DUI, and then the person becomes eligible for the alcohol education program. We would love to have a statutory commitment that makes only one pretrial diversionary program, namely the AEP program, relevant to DUI offenders. It's a very strange anomaly where you have the youthful offender who's being charged with an adult violation but is still getting pretrial diversionary program. So it might be something we might want to consider because we are potentially extending that first conviction up to almost a third. So thank you.
So for any of these drivers that are convicted of an alcohol-related offense, the 227A, they're required to complete the substance abuse treatment program, and that's through the Department of Motor Vehicles. There's a number of vendors that you can complete that program with, and that's for everybody. The second DUI offense for those under 21 is 3 years or until they're 21, whichever is longer, it's supposed to say. It's longer. If you are over 21, you are suspended for 1 year and then required for 24 months to have an ignition interlock device installed in any car you own or operate. There's no requirement for an IID for a second offense on an operator under the age of 21. For those operators with a third DUI, it's a lifetime penalty, which is really, in fact, a 6-year penalty, because after the statute was changed last year to allow operators who have been permanently suspended to apply to the commissioner for reconsideration of the penalty after serving a minimum of 6 years and completing anything else that they may have otherwise outstanding, which may include the substance abuse treatment program, which may include an operator retraining requirement, which could include unpaid tickets. Whatever else is outstanding needs to be cleaned up. But after 6 years, the lifetime might not be lifetime. And then one of the conditions is that they'd have an ignition interlock installed in their vehicle until they had served a total of 10 years of suspension, presuming they're successful in their request for modification. And actually, our first hearing on that's coming up next week. Not a kid, though. This is just some information we thought you might like to know, that there are 209 convictions of 1436C, the learner's permit violations. This is where they operated without a licensed driver in their car, learner's permit violations. There's 209 of those on the driving histories right this minute. We also have 1425 violations of 1436G, which is the issue about carrying passengers in your car. We know there's 1,425 convictions on the driving histories. 84 people have two or more convictions, but only 38 have been suspended as a result of that. And one of the reasons only 38 are suspended is because the law currently says that you need to have the violation on two separate occasions. And what we have found is that police officers often issue a ticket if I'm in my car driving and I have my two friends in the car, that the police officer writes the ticket for two violations, but they're not separate occasions, so they don't get suspended. So it goes on your driving history, but there's no impact until you do it again. If you remember back to the other person's driving history, they did it more than one time before they got suspended. They need to be separate occasions. And these are our statistics about the administrative per se suspensions. In 2005, 6, and 7, the numbers go up. The suspensions are increasing for those under 21. I'm sad, sorry to say. And they're minimal increases in the over 21 group. That's through 3 years separately. We also have the numbers for the DUI convictions, and you'll notice that those are substantially less. These are the court process, and if you remember, I said those really are not connected and really don't have any impact on the other. But the numbers go down for the under 21. Oh, they go down for both groups, but they go down dramatically for the under 21 group. And I have to believe that maybe they're taking the youthful offender status. I mean, we don't know how we get those numbers. And that's it. Is there questions that we can answer, yeah. Susan or I? Or have
Kathy, can you go back two slides to the admin per se statistics?
Oh, I don't know if we can do that. Now you're pushing your luck. Page up. One more.
Yeah. It's a 400% increase. Any speculation as to why?
I don't want to speak for Kathy or Susan, but I don't think from there and in a position to speculate why.
The only thing I might suggest, and I can't attest to the accuracy of this, is that there's an additional step that's necessary to be taken with an under 21 under the zero tolerance law, which means that the police officer has to also send information so that the under 21 operator gets a suspension hearing, not just the per se, but the underage suspension, which they have not been translating. Maybe you're not clear on what I'm saying. Okay, what I'm saying is if you're under 21, you should be going under the zero tolerance. Mm-hmm. A lot of police officers, when this first was initiated, we found were not taking that additional step, and that the courts were not taking the additional step of translating the zero tolerance back to the DMV. That's the only thing I can think of, but I'm not sure that's an accurate explanation of it. Otherwise, it's I'm as perplexed as you are.
Kathy, if I might, I assume that the way that we gathered these administered per se numbers, and correct me if I'm wrong, or if you don't know, that's okay too, was really from our record. It wasn't the offense, it was a DUI offense, and then we just backed out the ages from the driver license. In other words, that's how we pulled it out of the system. Or did it come in as an under 21 treated as a different offense, which might be an explanation as to how it was transmitted, or did we really pull this off based on the age of the offender? Do you know?
Well, my understanding is that we pulled this information off our system based on the age of the offender.
That's what I thought.
Right, yeah, out of the administrative per se system.
Right. So I think that explanation that Susan gave may not work. It just depends how I'm not sure how we collected the data. I mean, I'm sure it's accurate, but whether there's a category of offense of under 21, whether it was pulled from that category or were pulled from the bigger subset of all DUI per se convictions and then matched it against driver license history and segmented it that way, it might give you a different number. All I will say, though, is we would have been consistent in each of the 3 years. We would have used the same method for each of the 3 years.
The statistics that I got from Lynn Payne, who's the manager, right, division manager over administrative per se unit, and it came out of her system. They didn't look at the driving history at all.
Okay.
It was what they entered for those years. Well, for that age.
I'll get back to you as to how they pulled it out to see if that contributes to it. Though it's my suspicion, so it may be that there's more reporting of it as opposed to more incidents, and we'll try to check how we gathered that and get back to you on that. Please proceed.
Yes, good morning. On your blood alcohol levels for your teens, how are they obtained? Is it by a legal blood alcohol level from at the scene, or is it because they were involved in a motor vehicle crash?
It could be any of those. Whatever the police officer does at the time of the arrest.
Now, I know that what we do with trauma patients, when they come in from a motor vehicle crash and they're seen and evaluated, we obtain a blood alcohol level, but it's a medical blood alcohol level. It's not a legal blood alcohol level, because the legal ones have to have a chain of custody. Do those, it's not a requirement, but it's a recommendation to send the violation of a medical blood alcohol and or drug violation to the DMV. Are those numbers in this, or are they...
I believe any reports that they had in their system are what they gave to us. Understand completely? Mm-hmm. That's what we asked for.
But typically, the administrative per se cases have to be based on an arrest. Those cases come because a police report called an A44 is sent to our department. When we receive that report from a police department that starts the administrative process under a statutory time frame of specific dates that we have to notify them of a hearing, otherwise the case is thrown out. We notify them of an intent to suspend. They then can ask for a hearing. If they do, we have to hold the hearing within X number of days and proceed that way. So these numbers, I believe, would be based on we received a police report telling us there was an arrest for operating under the influence of drugs or alcohol and being specific about that. That is sometimes accompanied, the large majority of cases, with an breath alcohol test result from an intoxilizer 5000M, I believe. But some of the cases are blood cases, which would be the others. But that would have been collected by the police officer. They may have gotten that by a search warrant issued for hospital records, or so that would have been through a chain of custody. I don't think we start any cases based on a hospital report having been sent to us, because we base it on an arrest only. If we didn't get it on a police arrest record called an A44, then the department doesn't have the authority to move forward. But I'll check to see what happens. I don't know if we receive separate records, whether those just supplement an arrest file, and that's what I believe they would be. But these are all based on arrests. And Susan is saying, from the prosecutor's side, they only accept the records from hospitals pursuant to a search warrant, so that they're sure that if it needed to be used in a criminal proceeding, that the chain of custody is met. And that essentially applies to us as well. We take either the intoxilizer report from attached to the police report, or if it's supplemented by a blood test, it would have gotten to us through the police, and therefore is part of a police report. It may come in as, you may get the one report, and then you may get a follow-up with the blood report, maybe a supplemental report. Tim?
A question for Susan. If someone has a conviction for a serious offense and they're required to come to court, can they pretty much get a number of continuances? I mean, is the court system, you know, on notice to not grant a continuance, for particularly if it's a youthful driver?
Well, for the youthful offender group, I'm not addressing that, but for the young operator, we do our very best not to permit the defendant to manipulate the system in order to take advantage of his opportunities to operate a motor vehicle before the consequence and the penalty is imposed. Prosecutors do object to requests for continuances, and those objections are usually addressed by the court, and continuances, you will not find repeated continuances, particularly if it's a motor vehicle crash, and we need to be advised if that is happening anywhere. We're pretty well on top of it, and the policy is to limit and restrict the pendency of the case to get it done, because we want the consequences to enter.
On the administrative per se side, you're entitled to one continuance only. There's a strict time frame, and we absolutely stick to those strict time frames. So on the administrative sanction for operating under the influence, whether it's a young driver or an adult, it doesn't make any difference. There really are set time frames, and it's a one continuance. I forget for how many days. It's like less than 30, I shouldn't guess.
15
days, and that's it. There are no other continuances. Sharon?
I can tell you from my own experience with the judicial system that continuance after continuance is a problem, and it does afford the offender to reoffend, and some of the court systems in the various jurisdictions do not communicate well together, and so may not be aware of offenses in every jurisdiction. And if I may just change the subject, Kathy, is it my understanding, I'd just like to clarify something I think I heard, a teenage driver who is possessing alcohol in a vehicle and is charged with that offense will lose his license for a period of time, but will not but there will not be any points assessed on his driving, his or her driving record. Is that correct? Thank you.
Any other questions for Kathy or Sue? If not, I would thank you both very much for presenting this, and I think it is useful to the committee to understand what happens with the records and what the department does with it. And I will just like to publicly say, and Kathy and Sue are two of the people that I go to when I don't understand what's happening within the agency, because they do know how everything works and do a really good job of keeping track of the records and staying on top of stuff. And the angry people who are suspended, or they listen to them all day long and handle that quite well, and are pretty much no nonsense. Here's the rules. Here's what you have to do. And I thank them for their work. Why don't we? It's about 12 minutes after. Take about a 5-minute break. Resume, or say 7 minutes. We'll resume at 11:20 with the remainder of our agenda. Can I ask any members to take their seats? Thank you. Well, this is a very good group. In the legislature, nobody sat down that quickly when they called the meeting back to order. Now move to item 4 on the agenda, which is the consideration of the short-term recommendations from the legislative subcommittee. If you all have the agenda in front of you, they're broken down into 7 items and then several sub-items within that. I was going to suggest as a procedure, since it's on the agenda, that motion's already been made to approve those, on each item, ask if there's any objection to that item. If there's none, I'll presume it moves to the consent calendar. We'll do one vote for all the pieces to which there's no objection to or difference of opinion about. If there are any items that there's either need for further discussion or some slight difference of an opinion, we'll hold that for a moment, come back to it, I mean today, but we'll get move through all the things of which there's no objection and come back to anything that anybody has any reason to say no, it's not a consent just in that form. And by that, I don't mean you're objecting to a proceeding. If you simply want to say, no, there's more that needs to be said on that, or I might want a little change in it, just say that. We'll pass it for the second, get through all the other consent ones just in terms of time, and then proceed to those items that need further explanation or discussion. And again, I'm sort of laying this out as a process. If at any point somebody thinks they're not being heard or thinks something isn't the right process, raise your hand. We'll recognize you and we'll address it. It's not meant to use any procedure to cut anybody off in any way, just to try to move expeditiously. With that, I'll go to the first item, which is the elimination of the youthful offender pleas for moving violations. I think we saw from the demonstration from the folks from DMV that there are over 300 of those cases for youthful offenders that DMV can't sanction because we're not told of the records. Is there any objection to including that in our recommendations for short-term solutions, being that youthful offender status cannot be used for a motor vehicle violation? Sherry?
I would like us to perhaps consider a modification to include DUI.
Oh, it was. I did intend by moving violations to include DUI. So it'll be, I don't think that needs a modification. It is DUI is a moving violation. It's a good point to raise, though. But certainly, I intended by this and the language of this was intended to include all violations, whether it's reckless driving, DUI offenses, or anything of that sort, or just. And in fact, that's where it's most often used is the serious offenses. People aren't wasting youthful offenders on, say, a speeding ticket. When I say wasting, because you can use it once in a lifetime, so they're not using it for a speeding ticket. But things where there were more serious sanctions is where it had been used. It certainly was intended to cover that. That's a very good point. Any other issues on that point? Then I'll assume that moves to a consent list. Item number 2 was to strengthen the penalties under the Administrator's Per Se program for teenage drivers who fail alcohol, drug, or urine tests. Is there consensus that we wanted to recommend the strengthening penalties. And I would point out that there was a bill that just passed the legislature a day or two ago, was part of the large bill on criminal laws sanctioning, that made clear that the penalties should be the same for it. There was an anomaly in the law that if it was a blood test, the penalty didn't wind up doubling for a youthful offender, but it did for a breath test, and it closed that anomaly. So that's already been accomplished. But this is to say there should be a more significant penalty. It doesn't specify exactly what that should be, but if it's administered per se, there should be a more significant penalty if it's a youthful offender that violates it. That law should be strengthened. Is there objection to making that recommendation? Then that will be considered one of the consent items. The next is essentially seat belts, to amend 1436GA4 to require that all passengers in all seats in any vehicle operated by a driver under age 20 wear a seat belt, and increase the penalties for drivers 16 to 19 who do not wear their seatbelt, and to have that apply as points toward the license for suspension revocation. Is there any issue or objection or concern about that item? Seeing none, that will be part of the consent motion. Very significantly, the next item, number 4, is to revise passenger restrictions for 16 to 19-year-olds to the following sequential periods. During the entire period that the driver holds a learner's permit, with the current law and the exception, if you're in a driving school program, you have no passengers except a parent or guardian who's supervising the driver. Then extend for the first 6 months after you receive a learner's permit that there are no passengers except the parent or guardian or one licensed driver over 20, in other words, another supervising adult. And then item C, for the next 6 months, no allowable passengers other than immediate family members. So that we're clear on this, what we're saying is the learner's permit will now be 6 months with just parent, and then an additional 6 months was just parent or siblings or immediate family member. So effectively you would be 17 before you have an unrestricted license. Is there any objection to those changes in the graduated driver's license? Seeing none, that will be part of our recommendation on the consent motion. If I might, because I think there'll be some discussion on 5, I'm going to skip to 6 and 7 and then come back to 5. 6, as soon as this can be accomplished administratively, increase the learner permit required for supervised driver training from 20 hours to 50 hours. Is there objection to that being included in the list of items that will be part of the consent motion? And then item number 7, to amend the nighttime driving curfew for drivers 18 and younger. The current curfew is midnight. This recommends a curfew of 10 p.m. Is there any objection to that being a recommendation?
I feel kind of obligated to say something because most teenagers would probably oppose this. Personally, I don't feel like it's really a solution because it doesn't make kids follow laws that they're not following. It just gets them off the road. And I feel like a 10 o'clock curfew nowadays is early enough that it's a little too extreme. I believe it should be more apparent enforcing and not something from the state saying you can't. Because for the majority of kids in the state, driving isn't something they do for freedom to go out with their friends. And nowadays, going out doesn't start till 8 o'clock after practice. Or, I don't get back from some track meets till 9, 10 o'clock. That's a huge impact. The time kids spend out is later nowadays. And I don't think it really, I think 10 is just very extreme. 12 o'clock is a very generally accepted curfew for high school. But 10 o'clock till you're 18, till you're going to college, that's a very significant, time to be home, and then you have freedom when you go to school. I just think that's a very, very, not, it's, it's I just feel it's far too early for people till they're 18.
Before fully open that discussion now, because we were going to kind of do consent items, and I wanted to give you a chance to say that won't be part of the consent motion. We will come back to that item for further individual discussion. Yes.
Yes, on one, sorry to go back to one, but on the one where it talks about the provision of allowing the students to drive with going from 20 hours to 50 hours.
Yeah.
To add in there, which is what the Education and Training Committee was actually looking at, was to add in there a log on that 50 hours that certain specific requirements be added into that log of an extensive work with maybe, say, weather-related issues and nighttime driving, specific hours on those 50 hours, not just have 50 hours and that be it. Have specific guidelines that they have to meet based on those on that hour time frame.
Okay. So there's an amendment to it, just so I'm characterizing it correctly, that the 50 hours include a log to be submitted by the parent and perhaps the commissioner of motor vehicle further specify time periods within the 50 hours. So there's at least, for example, 10 hours being driving at night or something of that sort.
That's correct. Along with some weather situations. It doesn't have to be winter driving. It could be summer driving with rainstorms. You know, having some weather-related issues to handle as well. As well as having off the main road driving, driving on the interstate, driving in a high-volume area, driving in a rural area. Things like that is what we had talked about. And we hadn't drafted up the log, but we're willing to do so because we had actually talked about that.
Let me just ask the question of the committee. Given we're trying to do this in a short term and get something out, how do we want to phrase something about, because I don't want to delay taking action on the 20 to 50 hour recommendation. How do you want to proceed? What are thoughts on that, Tim?
Well, I don't think anything that Jillian just suggested is not subsumed in what we're recommending. Obviously, if we're going to increase the hours from, I think the subcommittee would say, if we increase the hours from 20 to 50, we'll also be looking for a better way to keep track of that or to document. And certainly Jim McPherson, who's on the subcommittee, has already stated quite succinctly about the different types of driving. So I certainly have no problem with adding a clarification. I think what Jillian is saying is actually what we were thinking is maybe didn't say it expressly.
And then I think, is that clear enough for members of the committee for us to take action on, and then we can probably provide some supplemental information to the legislature as the subcommittee further kicks around maybe sort of specific recommendations rather than give them the exact specific recommendations saying that we would include in our language 20 to 50 hours, including designated hours in varying times of day and road conditions, something to that effect, and with documentation, with the parent signing a log, if you will.
That's
and maybe
that's
the department
exactly,
to create
yep.
a form for that log.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what we're looking at.
May I say something, please?
Of course.
Yes, it is my opinion that the parents should be mandated to keep a log. They should include the beginning mileage, the end mileage, the starting time, the ending time, the driving conditions, road conditions, weather conditions, all that sort of information. It's so easy to lie about how many hours of driving you've given your teenager. And we find that this is already a terrible situation in our experience at our driving school. So if you have to go to all the trouble of creating a log, it's almost easier to just take your kid out. Because that's what I hear. Oh, well, people are going to make it up. Well, yeah, that's a lot of work. It's almost easier to just go ahead and do it if you're going to have to write it all down.
And I'll sort of, I guess I'll treat that as a friendly amendment then. It can still say as a consent item with that understanding. So we have item 7 temporarily being held that we'll come back to. Item 5 is now written. is saying using the Massachusetts model. I have a proposal to hand out, which I'll ask the staff to hand out now, which shows a Connecticut model. I think that was emailed to everybody. But knowing that, we'll need some discussion. While that's being handed out, I would say then that based on our procedure, we have a motion that has items 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6 as amended before us as a recommendation. Is there any objection to proceeding with a vote on that recommendation as we've discussed? If not, just in complying with all rules, I'll have a staff member call a roll.
If you are voting for someone else when the committee member's name is called, speak up, say who you are and who you're voting for, and we can move back to the other two items. Could you please call a roll?
Commissioner Ward.
Yes.
Dr. Goddard.
Dr. Gowling, yes.
Ms. Bello?
Yes.
Ms. Cruz?
Maria Cruz from Big A Driving School, Paul, 40 for Paul in the charge, yes.
Mr. Kim?
Yes.
Ms. Chapman?
Yes.
Mr. Ciato? Ms. Cipriano?
Yes.
Mr. Cristalli?
Yes.
Mr. Dabrowski?
Yes.
Mr. Damiano?
Yes.
Ms. Demchik Pasquale? Mr. Hollis?
Yes.
Mr. Hollister?
Yes.
Mr. McPherson? Ms. Mosher?
Yes.
Ms. Nade?
Yes.
Mr. Rio?
Lieutenant Bill Tyler, affirming the police for Chief Jim Rio, Chiefs of Police Association, yes.
Mr. Smolchuk?
Yes.
Mr. Terenzi?
Sergeant Mike Chigota from the State Police for Lieutenant Colonel Peter Terenzi, yes.
Mr. Thaw?
Yes.
And Mr. Wilsey?
Yes.
Total voting yes, 19. Absent not voting, 3.
The governor. Item number 7 was the nighttime driving curfew. We began to have a discussion on that. I'll treat item 7 as the motion now before us, which is the time for curfew being changed from 10 p.m. till midnight. Stephen, do you want to say something further? Because you would raise that issue, spoke quite well on it. Do you want to add something now, or do you want to have other people speak first?
No, I don't really have anything to add.
Okay. There are others. Dr. Graf.
Yes, I just wanted to know what the exceptions are and whether or not we have any information that shows that those 2 hours would make a substantial difference.
Tim, do you want to take a shot at that since it came from your subcommittee?
As to the second question, the data that we got from Dr. Preusser and Dr. Hedlund shows a pretty significant spike in the number of accidents and the number of serious accidents between 10 and 12, which is why we picked that. The exceptions are school activities, employment, religious activities, safe rides, and I'm thinking there's one more that I'm not remembering, but I think it's a pretty broad-based set of exceptions, and I think the best way to categorize the exceptions is the distinction that we drew 2 weeks ago between recreational driving and purposeful driving. The idea of moving it back to 10 o'clock is not to discourage so-called purposeful driving. If you're coming home from a school activity, if you're coming home from a job, we don't want to restrict that. We don't want to. We're going to trust both the teen and the sort of the reality that if you're driving because you have a reason to go home at a later hour, then you're going to do that more safely. What we're trying to avoid is 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, a couple of teens going from a party or just going for a joyride, get into a car, and that's what this is intended to to do. You know, Steve was very, very eloquent on behalf of his fellow teens, and certainly the letters that we got from Litchfield High School, almost to a person, said the problem with the curfew is it makes us speed to get home by midnight. And you know, I gave my response to that last time. I don't know that's a valid reason to not have a curfew. Sort of in response to Steve, I would just say what I said 2 weeks ago, which is that, is this difficult to enforce? Yes, but the state needs to set a standard to help the parents to know what is the consensus of people who've looked at the issue as to what is a good time frame when teens have to remember this is teen drivers under the age of 18. We're setting a standard, and we're saying we've looked at the data jump out at us as to what the problem is. And we're asking parents to help us enforcing this standard, which is backed up by the data.
Thank you.
Commissioner, I'd just like to add to what Tim has said. You know, we've looked at this closely from a research standpoint. My clinical experience as a surgeon that takes care of children injured in trauma, there is a disproportionate number of accidents which occur between 10 and midnight. And, you know, I empathize with Stephen's comments. Having grown up in Connecticut when I was 16, 17, and 18, I would have vehemently been opposed to this. But from a public health standpoint and the standpoint as a physician that cares for injured children, I think this is a critical component of what we're going to recommend to the governor.
Thank you. Yes, Rosemary.
Well, there are some components that I really concur with our student representative, and the point of him making is a drastic change from 12 to 10 o'clock. I think I'd feel more comfortable with 11 o'clock, but I also feel that the way that we have point number 7 written, and it says with the current exceptions, that really needs to be clarified, and I think it should be stated on here what are those exceptions. Because I think that's where the students are having difficulty, just saying exceptions, that all school activities. And school activities run the gamut from not only the sports, the theater, we have play practices, we have dances, we have competition. There's so many things that happen in high schools today in the evening, and I just have difficulty with that 10 o'clock restriction. I feel more comfortable with an 11 o'clock time frame. And the second point I reiterate is that those exceptions need to be listed.
The exceptions are listed in the statute. I just didn't want to. Okay. I have no problem with listing. We could even make part of our recommendation with additional clarification as to what is meant by a school activity exception. I'm going to respectfully disagree with. I'm not sure 11 versus 10 makes a difference, or at least I think the subcommittee didn't feel that was a distinction we wanted to make. And you know, the data are there, simply between 10 and 11. But I absolutely accept the idea that we should be very clear as to what is and what is not a permissible exception, particularly as regards school activities.
Let me just indicate procedurally then, as we submit a report to the governor, we'll come back to the hour. Whatever the hour says, it will say the current exemptions, which are, and then spell them out as currently in the statute. And as I understand that, I believe it was school activities, work, and perhaps religious activities, if I remember correctly.
Safe Rides.
Oh, and a Safe Rides program.
Purposeful.
And I think Dr. Preusser correctly talked about being what he described as purposeful driving. But we'll... medical was the other one. We'll make sure that we track that statute and include that in our recommendation, that we're not asking for a change in the exceptions, if you will, from current law, but spell them out so people see what they are in our report. With that, I would come back to discussion between midnight and 10 or midnight and 11. Go ahead. Judge.
Well, I want to actually second consideration of 11 o'clock. And is there a statistical basis to move to 10 versus 11? Did the subcommittee actually consider 11, or did you just focus on 10 and decide, did you really think about 11 o'clock as an alternative and then reject it based upon statistics? And are there actually statistics which would justify moving it to 10 as opposed to 11? I mean, I'm not privy to the specifics of that statistical basis or your experience, but I'm a little bit troubled by this, moving it up to 10 o'clock. And
well, the subcommittee did consider 11 versus 10, and the data, particularly that we got from Dr. Preusser and Dr. Hedlund, which was distributed, in fact, it's attached to, if you have the short-term recommendations from 2 weeks ago, the one of the attachments was Dr. Hedlund's memo, and there's a bar graph. It's on page nine of the short-term recommendations. There is a jump from 9 to 10, and then a bigger jump from 10 to 11, and an even bigger jump from 11 to 12. And those data there go in increments of 50. So there's a jump of about 50 per hour from 10 to 11, and another 50 or so from 11 to 12. And we thought that was sufficient data. There's also, in the United States, is my understanding, there are some states that are now at 9 o'clock, North Carolina being one that I'm aware of. But so it's not as though we're going past new ground that has been adopted elsewhere in the United States. So, Al, the answer to your question is yes, we looked at 11, and yes, we thought we have the data to recommend 10 o'clock.
I'm trying to call from the survey that was done. Was there separate data on parental support between 10 and 11 on the curfew? Dr. Hedlund?
Yes, there is. There was a follow-up question. The initial one was, do you support it earlier than the start of the midnight? Those are the data that I showed you. The follow-up question only asked those that did support an earlier time. The question is, what is the earliest time you would still support? And the responses were 50% said 11 p.m. and 38%, 44%
said 10 o'clock or earlier. So it was about 50-50. Those who support earlier time, half of them said 11 o'clock, the other half said 10 or earlier. That's clear.
I think so.
It's a fair interpretation, and I'm not trying to play with the numbers, that then it seems like a quarter of the total respondents supported 10 p.m., 50%. Because if you supported 10, you could also support a restriction of 11. Not that you recommended it, but if 10 was okay, 11 wouldn't be objectionable. It's too early. The 50% supported that, and then about 50, based on that one survey, didn't support that, just so I understand the numbers.
That is correct.
Okay.
Approximately 50% support something earlier, which means 11, and approximately a quarter would support 10 or earlier.
Josh,
I mean, Tim, if you're going to base the subcommittee's recommendation and the 10 o'clock curfew on a statistical analysis, the chart would actually cause you to impose a curfew right after school, which is where the highest, and Tim and I are neighbors, and we both lost children, and I lost my son right after school. And that's where the huge spike is. I'm not buying into the statistical analysis, because if you base it singularly on that, there are other times other than 10 that could be justified based upon that kind of a factual foundation. In any event, I've said enough. I'm in favor of 11, and I'm going to object, but not to the change of the time. I'm going to object to 10 o'clock when the vote comes, simply because I believe 11 is the more appropriate time.
I'm just going to give a little bit of background to that, because we did consider that specific issue, and Jim, feel free to jump in if I misspeak. We know the numerators as far as the numbers of crashes, and you're exactly right to say that there's a disproportionate number of crashes that occur right after school. But the number of teenage drivers on the road is highest at that time.
as far as fatal crashes which occur, there is a much larger number that occur between the 9 p.m. and midnight time, because that's when the risk-taking behavior is occurring, and also that's when teens are driving at night, which is a very risky time for them to be driving. So, we very closely considered, this issue, and, we think we have very good data to support it. You know, from a public health standpoint, not from a public opinion standpoint, which is an important distinction to make.
Given that there are two members that have suggested 11, I think probably the fairest way to proceed is, Rosemary, you did it first, is that a motion to amend it from 10 to 11, and then we can vote on that and see where we are.
Then I'd like to make the motion that it be amended to 11 o'clock instead of 10 p.m.
And, Judge, I treat that as seconded. So that for this purpose now, that motion is before. Is there further discussion on the amendment to the motion? Tim.
I just want to make this one general point, and I will make the same point when we get to number five. We are not the ultimate decision makers here. The governor and the legislature are the ones who are going to decide this. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think if this task force takes a position, that's going to be the cap. And the legislators will get their input and talk to their constituents. But I only see our recommendations being, for lack of a better phrase, whittled down. I think there's something to be said for this task force taking the strongest position that we can reasonably support, because the legislature is going to make the final decision.
Further discussion, Judge.
Tim, I completely agree with you, and I thought that this committee ought to be aggressive, because I see exactly that happening. I see, if anything is going to happen, we're going to get whittled down, for lack of a better phrase, and I think that's probably an appropriate phrase. I don't want to make a proposal that could be adopted that I strongly disagree with. I just think 10 is too early. I suspect how the vote's going to go on this, so I won't say anything more. But I completely agree with your observation. That is, generally, we ought to be, as a general rule, pretty aggressive in what we recommend, with the understanding that there's a process that's going to be involved here, which will likely temper our recommendations.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I very strongly support the 11 p.m. and my rationale would be that I think it's too great of a time difference to go from midnight from 12 to 10 p.m. And I would like to see this in place with 11 o'clock and see how those statistics show the show incidents or improvement over the next year with this sort of with legislation that would support and put into place the 11 p.m. But I just think it's such a great distance that 2 hours is extreme for an adjustment for the high school students.
From Professor Stephen.
And just to add in, plus we're tentatively going to be adding in other new legislation and the new punishments and other things. So, there's already going to be more incentive for kids to drive earlier besides the 2 hour difference in when they have to stop. Just a good thing to keep in mind.
Further discussion, Rosemary.
I really emphasize educating the parents and educating the students, that cooperation and all the other points and components that we have to what we've been working on and what we're putting forth, that these are areas that I believe, taken in consideration with a reduction of 1 hour, that it's a full package that would lead to having better results with the youthful drivers.
For myself, I will say I'm torn by this, and I came here prepared to vote for the 10 p.m. I find myself being somewhat persuaded by an individual who works with the teenagers every day as a high school principal, saying if for this to be successful, parents have to buy into it too. I mean, it's the law and we're going to enforce it, but it isn't only going to be by law enforcement. It's not going to be the police officers in uniform. If parents aren't saying that's reasonable, obey the law, it isn't going to work in the long run either. Although we need penalties, and I believe in enforcement, so I'm sort of torn in that. And I think at least today, and I do understand what Tim's saying, is you don't want to come in so weak and somebody says, well, weaken it some more, and it doesn't end up being somewhere. But I guess I'll be voting with the amendment. If it fails, I'll be supporting the 10 p.m. because I think that's better than leaving it at midnight. So whatever that's worth, I'll explain my vote, I guess. and I didn't mean to cut off discussion. Is there any other discussion? Otherwise, I'll ask that the roll be called. Officer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Tim, I'd just like to know how the subcommittee came up with the 18-year-old guideline there. I'm concerned with the numerous universities, colleges within the state. That's going to be hard to enforce. Got a lot of 18-year-olds now, freshmen in college and stuff like that. So I know it's a little bit more maturity as they entered college, and that's a concern for enforcement.
Well, that's a good question, and we understand that this will affect some kids who are in their first semester of college. I guess the feeling is that the way the graduated driver license laws have already been set up, it addresses the 16 and 17-year-old. So we didn't want to mess with that categorization, I guess, is the best way. I mean, I agree, it's not a perfect system. I mean, I suppose you could think about extending it to everybody under 21 or rolling it back so it's only the 16-year-olds. But the GDL laws are for 16 and 17-year-olds, and we decided that this is an amendment to the GDL laws. We didn't want to change the characterization of who's covered by the GDL laws in addressing this particular change.
Further discussion?
I just want to supplement my remarks to make something clear in responding to what Tim said, and I do generally agree with him. Whatever we do here is going to be subject to, not generally, I agree, that whatever we do here is going to be subject to further review. But as a practical matter, I've always conducted myself for 37 years as a 23 as a prosecutor and the last 15 as a judge by fundamentally doing what I feel is right, and I feel 11 o'clock is right. To recommend 10 o'clock with the assumption that someone's going to reconsider this and knock it down, that doesn't make 10 o'clock right. I think 11 o'clock is the right time, and to move it to 10 because the legislature may very well, in response to public surveys and reactions, strike a compromise at 11 with that expectation. I just think violates my ethical and moral responsibility. I think 11 is right. I'm not willing to vote for 10 on the assumption that the legislature may strike the compromise that I want. I just think 11 is the right time.
Clarify one point, because when we ask the age question in 18, the current law is for 16 and 17-year-olds, or is up to your 18th birthday. Although the way we have it typed in front of us, we say 18 and younger. Tim, is it my understanding? I did understand the subcommittee accreditation to be the current graduated license law, which is under 18, not 8. In other words, you're not 18 in 3 months. It's for 16 and 17. When you hit your 18th birthday, it ends, just to be sure that our language is correct.
Right.
And I think it is also correct. That might mean some... I guess I was halfway through my first semester of college before I had my 18th birthday, but certainly most college students, once you're, and Tim is correct, if you're past the first semester, the odds are you're not talking college students, but you might be talking some. But if we were fully 18 years old, you probably have people that are legally adults for all kinds, for every other purposes except alcohol. So you don't mean that. You mean the current graduated license law, 16 and 17. Should say under 18. Just for clarification, that's what was meant by it. That's not a change. Sorry to do that after you spoke, Judge. Is there further discussion? If not, then I would ask to call the roll on an amendment to the curfew. So the proposal is that the curfew would be changed from 10 from current law of midnight to 11 p.m.
With all the current prescriptions in the law being part of that.
Commissioner Ward.
Yes.
Dr. Guy. Ms. Bella?
Yes.
Ms. Cruz?
No.
Mr. Campbell?
No.
Ms. Chapman?
No.
Mr. Ciotta? Ms. Cipriano?
Yes.
Mr. Cristalli?
No.
Mr. Dabrowski?
Yes.
Mr. Damiano?
No.
Ms. Demchik-Pasquale? Mr. Hollis?
Yes.
Mr. Hollister?
No.
Mr. McPherson? Ms. Mosher?
No.
Ms. Nady?
Yes.
Mr. Rio?
Tyler for Chief Rio, yes.
Mr. Smolchak?
Yes.
Mr. Terenzi?
Sergeant Michael Chigora for Lieutenant Colonel Peter Terenzi, no.
Mr. Thaw?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Those voting yes, 10. Those voting no, 9. Absent not voting, 3.
The motion passes. The motion now is amended to be before us for a curfew of 11 p.m. All the other things that we stated previously are part of that. Is there further discussion about the motion as amended? If not, is that at this time a consent item? Seeing no objection, that will be treated as a I guess actually to follow the rules, since we already voted on the consent items, we'll have to have a roll call vote. So.
Yep. Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Dr. Guy? Ms. Bello?
Yes.
Ms. Cruz?
Yes.
Mr. Campbell?
Yes.
Ms. Chapman?
Yes.
Mr. Seattle? Ms. Cipriano?
Yes.
Mr. Cristalli?
Yes.
Mr. Dabrowski?
Yes.
Mr. Damiano?
Yes.
Ms. Demchik-Pasquale? Mr. Hollis?
Yes.
Mr. Hollister?
Yes.
Mr. McPherson? Ms. Mosher?
Yes.
Ms. Nade?
Yes.
Mr. Rio?
Lieutenant Taylor for Chief Rio, yes.
Mr. Smolchak?
Yes.
Mr. Terenzi?
Sergeant
Jigoro
for Colonel Ferrandi, yes.
Mr. Paul?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Those voting yes, 19. Those absent or not voting, 3.
The motion passes. Then return to item... Actually, before returning to item 5, let me just ask for clarification on item 4. We talked about revising passenger restrictions. The typed version says 16 to 19-year-olds, and we were referring to the graduated driver license law, which actually is 16 to your 18th birthday. And I assume that's what was meant by that motion, Tim, but I don't mean to revisit something. But I think the intent of that motion had been the current graduated driver license extending the periods wasn't meant to be 19-year-olds. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And actually, now that I look at it, the age really doesn't matter, because it's just the sequential periods. Whatever age the driver happens to be, which almost always is going to be in the 17-18 range, whatever age that person happens to be when they get through the sequential periods is what it is. So.
I think that's correct. Also, once you hit your 18th birthday, you don't need to get a learner's permit. You can just go in and get a driver's license.
Which is another issue, but...
It is another issue, but it's. I'm just saying It wouldn't trigger that, but I just didn't... Right. Because of the way this is written, I just want to make sure that the committee's clear on what we're recommending to the governor and that we're saying it to the public correctly, that revising the passenger restrictions was meant to extend the time of holding the learner's permit for the period set, not to change the ages of the learner's permit.
Yeah, sure. So the clarification would be revised passenger restrictions under the GDL laws.
Correct. Is there any objection to that? I think it's just clarification. Is there any objection or belief that that wasn't stated correctly? All right, we'll just make that part of the record then. Thank you. Return to item 5, which was to increase the penalties for moving violations committed by teenage drivers using as a model the Massachusetts newly adopted matrix. I've asked some staff to hand out, which I had emailed to folks, and I'll treat that as the motion, but certainly there's every right to amend that motion in any manner anybody sees fit, so that we had what would I would call a Connecticut matrix. And it shows specifically the first, second, and third offenses, the penalties for the specific items. In summary, what it does is provide a 30-day suspension for a first offense of either the passenger or curfew or cell phone restrictions, a 45-day suspension for a speeding restriction, and then increasing those to 90 days in the event of a second offense and to 6 months in the event of a third offense, except for the speeding goes to 6 months and then a year on a second or third offense. The reckless and street lacing also are, those are much less of those occur, so I'm not referring to them, but you have that in front of you as to what those are with the suspension periods. The $125 license restoration fee for a first offense is already the law in Connecticut. Anytime your license is suspended, once you've fulfilled whatever you need to fulfill to get it back, you pay a fee of $125. The fine is listed, I believe, is what the current infraction schedule calls for those offenses. So it's not really a change in those fines. What it adds substantially is the suspension period. In addition to that, it is adding to the offenses that were indicated, a requirement to participate in the driver retraining program. And that is even for a first offense of a passenger restriction, a curfew, or a text message violation that you would need to attend the driver retraining. Is that correct? So that there's something additional that's required of that, and that's the driver retraining that is part of that motion. And we're pointing out that current law authorizes the suspension of a driver for a second violation of until age 18. That under current law, if that was to happen, it's not one of those automatic suspensions that goes out, as was explained to you when Kathy was here, that the computer triggers it, the letter goes out and suspends. What that does instead is sends a letter saying, it triggers the opportunity for a letter to be sent to say there's a hearing that will be held, and following the hearing, a hearing officer might or might not suspend. The statute reads commissioner's discretion, but the process that was set up is that an independent hearing officer makes that decision. I would just point out that that's fairly rare that gets triggered, and that's different than an automatic suspension that just sort of goes into effect. There are certain hearing rights on an automatic suspension, but about the only thing that you're allowed to say at the hearing is, oh, that look, you got the wrong person, I didn't get the ticket, or I didn't plead guilty, your records are wrong. You don't get to go in and give a story as to why you shouldn't have gotten the ticket, or why you shouldn't have pled guilty, or why you shouldn't get the penalty. But the other process where it could be till age 18, that you do get to tell a hearing officer all the reasons why he shouldn't suspend your license. Just the automatic ones, you don't get to do any of those sorts of things. It's just did you mail the ticket in, or were you found guilty in court? Just so that you understand the difference. And I open it for discussion. Tim. Yield to my co-chair for a moment first, Dr.
Gell. Just a point of clarification. When we're talking about the use of the cell phone, are we talking about a hands-free situation, or are we talking they cannot talk on a cell phone?
For teen drivers, we're saying no use, hands-free or otherwise. That's the current law. Teen drivers, so we're clear on this, are not supposed to, under any circumstances, use a cell phone, whether it's with a Bluetooth earpiece, a plug-in earpiece, or hands-free. There's supposed to be no, or texting. There's supposed to be no use of electronic, that type of electronic device. And so this means any use of the phone, not just with a hands-free device, with or without a hands-free device.
Great.
With that clarification, Tim.
Thank you. I first, let me say on this particular issue, I think we have good choices. So I don't see this as we go one way, that's bad policy. If we go another way, it's good policy. I think we're now in agreement that there should be a matrix because it's clear and understandable, and it shows graduated penalties, and we're in favor of increasing the penalties. And the specific item I want to bring to the task force's attention is that the matrix that has just been passed out provides in most cases for penalties, suspension penalties, that are less than the Massachusetts matrix that was endorsed by the subcommittee. For example, the passenger restriction under license first offense in Massachusetts is 60 days. This matrix has 30. Second offense is 180. In Massachusetts, 90 days here. Third offense is 1 year on this matrix at 6 months. We have two good choices here, but I just want to say one word in favor of the way it was drafted by the subcommittee. Again, I made my point that we're not the decision makers here, and I think particularly on this item, what we recommend to the governor and the legislature is going to become the cap. Second, there is evidence, albeit preliminary, from Massachusetts that their matrix has been very effective. There have been a huge increase in license suspensions, and I have to assume the teens in Massachusetts are getting the message. Third, I think especially for second and third offenses, these types of suspension penalties are uniquely within the control of a teen driver. I think, personal opinion, the first offense is one thing. Anybody can make a mistake. But I think young drivers and their parents, if they have one moving violation on their record, figuratively speaking, ought to be driving on eggshells. They should understand one false move and you are going to get a penalty that should really make you drive 25 in a 40 mile an hour zone. It should be a situation where there's no room for error. So again, I understand the reasons for the changes, but I do want to say that word in favor of the higher penalties, particularly for the second and third offense, that and particularly for the licensing portion, the learner's permit, I think is somewhat less important because you're less likely to have a second or third offense when you're just on a learner's permit. So what we're really focusing on is second and third offenses for license. I would say a word in favor of the original penalties in the matrix. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Further discussion, please.
Yes. In our first discussion that we had last month or beginning of the month on our matrix that we had initially reviewed, I mentioned something about parental involvement in the matrix. I don't see that in here at all. And I know there's some driver retraining, and the Massachusetts program has the SCAR program and the attitudinal retraining programs. I think that we need to, along with the mention that we said earlier, where the parents don't even get information that these teenagers are getting their license, getting tickets and or suspensions, the initial suspension could be hidden from the parents. There needs to be some parental involvement or guardian involvement from after the first offense. Okay, everybody has a chance to make a mistake. We give them the blessing of the first offense. Second offense, parental involvement needs to be there. And you need to have somewhere where they can be either an advocate for the teenager or stand up in front of the judge and say, I'm here to fight for the student and or find out that the parents had no knowledge.
Tim.
I think everyone on the subcommittee would agree with what you just said. I think the matrix was, remember, this is a short-term solution. This is hopefully headed for the legislature next week. The creating a Connecticut equivalent of the driver attitudinal retraining and the SCAR is we view it under the long term. It, just because we can't get it done in the next 10 days. but I think the subcommittee would be completely on board with what you just said. But it's a longer-term item for us. That's the way I viewed it.
Listen, Tim, I did kind of view it that way, too, as I was trying to put a matrix together because I wasn't sure just what was in what the details of the other program were, but we did put in our driver retraining program, so there's clearly that requirement that you have to complete that program. Perhaps we could include that when you submit proof you've attended driver retraining, that it also include a reaffirmation by the parent that they want the license restored, because that I don't think that's it. I'll get shot when I get back to the office. I don't think that's too administratively burdensome. I don't know if I'd want to agree today that we'll quickly be sending parents notices. As I explained before, we need to figure out how we can send those notices. I hate to give my department a requirement to do something that's a good idea, but that we don't have a physical ability to do until we figured out how to do it. And I don't want to do something that might have a big fiscal note on it, but I think we could treat it as a friendly amendment that as part of the driver retraining, that also a parent re-signed for the license restoration, because I think we'd have a way to, you know, we have to get proof that you finished the driver retraining certificate. It might not be that hard to also say that proof form has to have a parent or guardian signature on it, just as you did on the license. I think we could probably find a way to administer that. So, and it seems like that was meeting with some of what the subcommittee wanted in terms of parent notifying, so that part of doing driver retraining with a parent reaffirmation that they wanted the license issued. And obviously then they have to know why they had to sign that new paper, so the kid's got to explain something to mom or dad. Is there objection to including that? I'll treat that then as a friendly amendment to the First Amendment and include that as part of that. Yes?
Excuse me. Commissioner, my name is Kevin Bork with the Injury Free Coalition for Kids. Dr. Campbell was called away and asked me to step in and vote in his stead. Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you.
If I could just comment on the driver retraining programs.
Sure.
Right now, the current operator retraining program doesn't really treat 16 and 17-year-olds as a special class of licensees. This provides, if you include something here in the violations matrix, it for the first time recognizes that this is a unique class of operators who need special retraining, and it needs to be somewhere it's the first time under policy, at least, that you recognize that this is a special at-risk group that is not part of your traditional operator retraining efforts. And I think somehow, rather, this is an opportunity for the committee to make a policy statement regarding that. This is not business as usual, and this is a special class of operators that do require another kind of retraining program that is uniquely different from what you do for adult operators. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think you make a very valid point. I think as this is written, in part because it's a short-term solution, we weren't trying to change. I think the driver retraining program ought to be addressed by this committee, and we're going to look at it. But I don't know that we're ready to say what those changes should be today. And so but we didn't want there to be nothing. And so the real change, and I think we had the statistics, there were a fair number of we had a current law says under 24, a second moving violation, you get driver retraining. This is saying first of any of these violations, you get driver retraining, and that's a real policy change, along with a license suspension. I think we should, in the long term, look at whether maybe there ought to be different versions of driver retraining for different ages of license holder. But I don't know that we're prepared to say just at the moment what's in that criteria. And I will acknowledge that I think there are some weaknesses in the driver retraining program. And I say that because of the number of people that go through it more than once. So that tells you there are some issues there that we are aware of in the department, but we don't know that we've, as of yet, addressed solutions to them. But I think that's a valid point. Is there further discussion? And I say at this point, just so it's clear, then the motion before us is for the version that's in front of you in writing, not the Massachusetts version. Tim spoke to a reason for thinking a longer period was a better option. Not saying this is a bad option, but a better option. I don't mean to mischaracterize your words. But at this point, I'm treating it as a motion that's before us, unless I hear an objection to proceeding on that motion. first, before we vote on that, let me say to Tim and the subcommittee, thank you very much for the work that was done in a very short period of time. We have an extremely strong package of improvements to our teen driving law being put in front of this legislature, and to do that and have these kinds of discussions, and one of the votes was 10-9, but it was 10-9 about a change in it, not about the policy direction change. So there's virtually unanimous support for broad, significant reform, and I think that is excellent work from Tim's group and from all the members of this committee. With that free plug, let me ask, is there further discussion?
I assume the range on the speeding fines is based on the amount of speed over the posted limit. Is that why that range exists?
Or?
And actually, the actual fines are in the, generally speaking, in the court. There's the range is in the statute, and then the judicial department has a schedule, as I understand it, and some of that's affected based on the amount over and also where it occurs. The amount over the speed limit, not just the speed, but X miles over the posted limit.
Again, that's treating them like adults. I mean, do you want to take a special position on any speeding violation for 16 and 17-year-olds and a fixed fine for that violation? Just, again, an option.
I guess we'll say in terms of our recommendation, it's my sense that a lot of teens don't really pay those fines themselves. Some parents make them, some don't. The real change is they're going to lose their license, and I suspect that has a bigger impact on the young driver than whether they paid $150 or $200. I don't know.
Then why not go with the 90 instead of 45?
It was just my personal sense that 45 is a real significant amount of loss of license, and it would be sufficient to get the message through. Okay. That it's not too short to not get a young person's attention, and it is a big change from current law where you pay a ticket, maybe you explain to your mother or your father why you shouldn't have gotten the ticket, and mail it in. And now you're going to get a notice from us and your license is going to be suspended, and I think that will affect behavior. My belief that it can't. Knowing they'll lose their license is much more significant than
the only reason I single out speeding is because the data, most of the teen-related fatals in the state over the last 5 years have been associated with speeding-related factors. So that's why I raise the issue.
I think you raise a fair point. Where the start point is, it's hard to say there's a right number. That is why when we were putting it together with the department, we wanted it somewhat longer than the passenger restrictions, although I will tell you that I think the extra kids in the car is just as serious as maybe just as serious as speed, depending on the circumstances. With that, is there not further discussion? I will ask for a roll call vote.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Dr. Kyle?
Yes.
Ms. Bell?
Yes.
Ms. Cruz?
Yes.
Mr. Campbell?
Kevin Ward on behalf of Dr. Campbell, yes.
Ms. Chapman?
Yes.
Mr. Seattle? Ms. Cipriano?
Yes.
Mr. Kristoff?
Yes.
Mr. Dabrowski?
Yes.
Mr. Damiano?
Yes.
Ms. Demchik-Pasqua? Mr. Hollis?
Yes.
Mr. Hollister?
Yes.
Mr. McPherson? Ms. Mosher?
Yes.
Ms. Nade?
Yes.
Mr. Rio? Mr. Smolchuk?
Yes.
Mr. Terenzi?
Sergeant Mike Jagoda for Colonel Terenzi, yes.
Mr. Thaw?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Okay. Those voting yes, 19. Those absent, not voting, 3.
Passes. Thank you. To the next item on the agenda, and I realize it's already 12:30. We've listed reports from subcommittees. This was intended not necessarily to be detailed reports, but to give any of the subcommittees an opportunity to report anything they wanted on an interim basis to report, and I'll leave it up to them as to how long or short those are. Training and education.
I'll keep it short.
Our subcommittee met last week, and we had just a very limited amount of task force members, and so we're soliciting very heavily for some more viewpoints on for our committee. We're looking at educational opportunities for both nonprofit and profit opportunities. We've been able to solicit off the internet very profitable agencies that provide education for teen drivers. Very, very limited on non-for-profit information. So if anyone out there has any information, I would really appreciate any emails. What we're looking at doing is to possibly create some sort of brochure for those families that are financially impacted by not being able to afford the private driving education, to provide them something to show to, other than just the parental supervision in a car. Another thing that we're working on is looking at some of the DMV changes. And Commissioner Ward, I understand that this would probably be an impact on your section, but some things that came across were maybe increasing or randomizing some of the actual testing behind the wheel. The comments that we're coming back from is, it's not on the exam, I don't want to know about it. And so we're looking at maybe doing potentially some, maybe increasing the, instead of the 15-minute driving exam, randomly go into the half hour or an hour session, maybe once a day, once a week, whatever, so that student that comes in to take that written test and the driving test does not know what they're going to get, and that message getting across to them will maybe have them a little bit more aware that they need to be more aware of other things other than just the standardized 15-minute drive around the block. Another thing is to possibly, along with the brochure, is to provide some videos and or computer training for both the parent and the applicant during the licensure process. Does not have to be just during the permit, but during prior to getting their license, to research some educational programs. We found a couple videos that would be optimal, that could be purchased at a very low price. Some computer training programs that are also available for that. We also have discussed inviting Mr. D'Amato to talk for the program on what's been offered in Massachusetts, and we'll be getting back with him and the task force to see if he could present something that will an education and or retraining programs that are available there that are good programs to offer. And then the last thing is to just, again, advocate to try to get some more members to the committee. And we don't have a next date and time set at this point. We're hoping that we can work with Mr. D'Amato to get a program set up to invite as many as we can.
That's great. I will echo that. Anybody who has the time and interest that would like to serve with Jillian on that, you could use another couple of people on that subcommittee.
Varied viewpoints will be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. And even if it means some more work, we're interested in new ideas. So that's
absolutely.
In fact, I will just put on the table one of the things we've kicked around a little in the department and asked your committee to look at is whether right now you take a mini test to get a learner's permit. We're not so sure you shouldn't pass a full written test to get a learner's permit. So that there's sort of the focus, what are the rules of the road? You ought to know that even for the learner's permit. And then the driving school can really focus on good driving skills, good driving habits. And so one of the things that we'd require a change in law, but it's one of the things we think we might want to look at. Pass the written part to get the learner's permit. Then you pass that. Then you still have the driving permit. You get a learner's permit. You have a period of time. And then you come back in and take it on the road test. And they're now separated within the department. You do them on separate days anyway for the most part now. I've changed something within the department. So you take a written test. After you pass it, you make an appointment for the on-the-road test.
But from a couple of people, from a couple of the different driver education programs that I've just talked to personally, is that the pass rate, even for the written test, is about a 40%. Is that what... that's what I'm getting from them.
Interestingly, it varies. The teenagers pass at a higher percentage than that. Adults coming in for their first license pass at a lower percentage. Now, that's a lot of issues involved in that. I will say that adults coming in for the first time at any age often have language barriers, or often immigration
are immigrants, and so there are custom and language barriers that are maybe brought problems on the written test that most of the teenagers don't face. So there are some varying factors involved in it. So the pass rate amongst teens, I believe, is over 40% on the written part of the exam.
May I comment on this, please?
Sure.
Our teenagers at our school, I would say, pass the written by 98 to 99% margin. The adults are above 40%. It often is a language problem. Also, the fact that the adults don't know how to study properly, and they think they're going to glance at the manual and pass the written test, and that's not the case.
That's true. Our agents will tell us that the kids have read the book when they come
mm-hmm.
in. For the most part, they've studied it. That a lot of times adults coming in will say they read it, but it's pretty clear they didn't.
It's also our experience that there is no such thing as a standard 15-minute driving test. Every inspector has his own idea of what constitutes a proper driving test, and some inspectors come and are done in 10 minutes. I'm sorry, I know they're supposed to be out for 15 minutes, but some don't. They do basically do a drive around the block, back into a parking space, and come back. And other inspectors keep the kids out for 40 minutes. So we never know what we're going to get. It depends on what inspector shows up. So perhaps it's something for the commissioner to consider, re-education for the inspectors and some standardization as to what a testing procedure should be.
We will look at all those issues. I will tell you, as a department, we are also looking at a new system whereby the scoring of the test can be done electronically with an electronic pad with a GPS device attached to it that actually maps out the route that the driving test took, so there'd be an electronic record of where they drove. And so that would also tell you for how many minutes they drove. I believe it would tell you that. There are some things we're looking at in that area, but I'm interested in what your committee recommends to us finally as we move on with the long term. Thank you. Public and Parental Awareness Subcommittee.
First of all, say that Yvette Bello co-chairs this committee with me. We had our first meeting 2 days ago, Wednesday the 23rd, and we do have another meeting set for February 1st, and we will piggyback a third meeting to follow our next task force meeting. We have seven people on our committee. And we have seven topic proposals that we have begun to look at, and we will take them one at a time. We have at the meeting on Wednesday, we looked at three. The first issue that we supported unanimously was to provide for parent guardians to be notified of moving vehicles by drivers under the age of 18 violations. And the public that was present for our meeting also was very supportive of this particular proposal. The second proposal that we looked at required all teenage applicants for learner's permits to file with the DMV, sign parent-teen driving contract using the Connecticut Teen Partnership contract as a model. And we came to agreement that we felt that this would be too difficult to handle just from a paper and administrative standpoint, but that it's something to be considered by other groups such as insurance companies and even with training, that this contract be made available for parents and teens, and it may be a part of some of the training that's available. But again, it's a connection and bringing the parents and the young people to be working together. Having a contract filed away at DMV doesn't have the strength of an agreement between a parent and their children and child. So that was the third. And then the third point that we had reached, we're still working on this one, and we had that point was to allow parents and guardians to initiate or obtain license suspensions or revocations for drivers under the age of 18. So we're still under discussion with that. But we do have, an immediate short-term action that we would like the committee to consider, and that is that the Connecticut Association of Schools, CAS, be asked to recommend to its high school membership
that administrators in all the Connecticut high schools hold a short assembly, approximately 30 minutes, by the end of February with the age-appropriate group to review the current restrictions, to look at the findings from the telephone survey of the Connecticut parents and other adults on teen driving issues and initiatives, and the proposals we are recommending for short and long-term action, that which we have dealt with today. We want to be sure that, first of all, the drivers, the young drivers, the juniors and the seniors, the age group between 16 and 18 in all the Connecticut high schools, reaffirm they understand what the restrictions are at the present time, and for them to be aware of what we are doing and what those implications would be, not only for themselves, siblings, but other student young people that will be coming up through the ages in the high school. High schools throughout the state have very strong student leadership programs, and this is an opportunity that it can be taken even further. But this is a starting point. As we get into March throughout all the high schools in the state, we're dealing with CAP testing. We move into prom season, and that the next 40 days, again through the end of February, is an appropriate time for packets that would be put together by DMV and these be distributed out to the high schools immediately.
Take that part of the report actually as a motion, so that's a motion that we add to our short-term recommendations.
Correct.
The recommendation, not a mandate, but a recommendation that high schools hold a forum. Is that the right term? Or
short assembly.
Assembly. Short assembly. That's the word I was looking for.
Correct.
An assembly on the current laws and requirements for teen driving. I'm trying to summarize shortly,
right.
Briefly.
The current laws that are in place, the information that we received from the survey,
gotcha,
that was conducted, and the short and long term recommendations, that which we have in short for short term have approved so far today.
Is there objection to that being added to the short term recommendations? I should ask first if there's any further discussion on it. Judge,
you proposed that this assembly occurs by the end of February. I mean, the assembly needs to be comprehensive, well prepared, and well presented. And I think 30-day window is too short. I suggest 60 days would be a more realistic period of time. I'm completely in favor of the proposal, but I think to mandate and recommend that this be accomplished in 1 month is too quick.
Okay.
Also, I agree with the judge that 60 days is a good time frame, but maybe even provide a structured presentation, some guidelines to give them to use for their 30-minute assembly instead of just saying, okay, go do it. Giving them some of the statutes that are out there, some of the new things that we're voting on, recommendations, things that would be helpful to let them know what's actually going on. So give them guidelines instead of just say do it.
Right. We're very comfortable with that. So.
Further discussion?
If I could just add one.
Oh, sure.
Independent schools are not part of CAS, but we would want to make sure that all high schools, whether independent, parochial, public, all high schools.
Right. The recommendation of this committee would be all high schools.
Correct.
Right. With that clarification, is seeing no objection, that will be made part of our recommendation. It's not a law change, so I don't need to have a formal roll call vote, I don't think, but that will be part of the recommendations that we give to the governor and that we announce publicly, that there be an assembly within the next 60 days as outlined. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Part of that. Laws, policies. Tim, I think that's you.
We did not meet pending what was going to happen today, but I guess I have a question. Now that we have a list of recommendations, what happens from here? Is our subcommittee intimately involved taking the lead in actually drafting bills for the legislature? I just would use some guidance on what our role will be in, now that we have recommendations.
Sure, I would say two things. In terms of recommendations, this will prepare as minutes of this a report to the governor, as we've discussed. The governor, in deciding which of those to draft into laws, although I think obviously she's been made aware of the work as we're going along, so they've actually been working on that, will submit to the legislature those bills that she supports in a draft in draft form. So we don't need to draft them, because even if we did, the legislative process is they wouldn't really use ours. The governor would submit a proposed bill through the legislative commissioner's office. I believe we will see a number of these items when the governor gives her budget address on February 4th. The legislative process is the governor introduces her package of bills on that day to be signed by the leaders of her political party, legislative leaders of her party on that day. And it's my hope that we've influenced this process enough that a number of these will be in fully draft form signed on that day. I think it would be then important for members of the committee or the subcommittee when those, if the legislature, and they typically would provide a public hearing on those bills, that we provide some testimony that those were recommendations from this task force as further public support of them. Certainly at that time, if you thought there was something in the drafts that weren't technically right or whatever, it would be appropriate to share that with the legislative committee. But I don't think we have to really try to draft the bill. Given the deadlines, that's kind of going to be underway and happen over the next couple of days in any event. I also think, though, as we look at long-term solutions, there may be other law changes, and that would come within that. And again, you could talk about it either in the form of a general description of the change or more fully drafted bills if you want as a long-term. Nothing further on that. Dr. Galvin asked that we create a separate subcommittee on public health issues related to team driving, which runs through some of the other work, but thought it should have a special focus, and he's particularly interested within that to see if we should look at segments of the community of teenagers to be sure that we're addressing from a public health perspective. Is a solution that we have work across all of Connecticut, or are different solutions within different populations within Connecticut maybe be more effective ways? And so we agreed that that made sense to look at the issues from that perspective. And so we are creating that as a subcommittee. And I'm forgetting who's chairing that subcommittee, if that's been fully. Chief Rio will be chairing that subcommittee. And as with all the subcommittees, if any of you have an additional interest in working on that, please let the chief know, or through our office, through email, through our office, and we'll get you onto that list. Next to last item of business, we've scheduled the first of the public hearings, which will largely be focused on the long-term things that the law committee suggested. Obviously, people could also comment on the short-term, but we have some longer-term things issued and open for the general public to bring us any of their ideas, not just that. The first hearing will be at the Rocky Hill Town Hall, January 31st at 7 p.m., which we're viewing as a Hartford area and somewhat suburban setting. We will be looking to schedule in early February, one in the New Haven area, but being both New Haven area and specifically in an urban setting, and we are continuing to look at something in eastern Connecticut, probably in conjunction with the New London Day. And I believe we also have a request to do something out at Danbury High School. Is that correct? Yeah. And we will, I don't think we have a date yet, but we're looking to schedule another hearing with a focus in the western part of the state, and specifically at Danbury High School, because I think Stephen made that request, and so we're accommodating that. And it would be useful to hear directly from that other group that's directly affected, not just parents, but in fact the teen drivers. Next schedule for our meetings are February 15th and March 14th for subcommittee updates, with the understanding that April 4th we would be trying to take action on full receive full subcommittee reports on April 4th to meet our overall deadline. Are there any other issues that anyone wants to bring forward before we adjourn for the day?
Yes, Rose.
The location for the February 15th meeting, will we still be here?
Why don't I assume that that is here unless we if someone has another location they want to suggest, I'm more than open to that. I don't think we've specifically reserved a room yet.
We're in the process.
I guess I don't have a good answer for you. I guess we're looking to do it here. Again, if people want to suggest another location, I don't object to doing one. For a large meeting, if we can get these rooms, they're convenient rooms. Although, for some of where you live, it's not convenient, but the room itself is convenient.
My concern was if the legislature is in session and just made this has worked.
Right.
Fine for me.
That we need to resolve. It may be an issue of whether February 15th they're using all the committee rooms. We'll try to get that resolved shortly. Nothing else. Again, thank you everybody for your work. I must say that there was a lot of good work accomplished today. I look forward. I think we have a unique opportunity to see these things enacted into law this session of the General Assembly. Thank you all. With that, I'll declare the meeting adjourned.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you very much. I'll get it. Here, there's my mic.